We're going to start the next unit with a continuation of the overall process that we ended the last unit with. So it's not a brand new topic, in a sense, because we still haven't gone all the way through the complete oxidation of glucose. Recall that the complete oxidation of glucose is more than just cellular respiration. It starts with glycolysis and then continues on with cellular respiration. It includes not only glycolysis, but oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, the citric acid cycle or tricarboxylic acid cycle, and then finally oxidative phosphorylation. And that's where we are right now, at the beginning of oxidative phosphorylation. That includes what two major steps? Electron transport and chemiosmosis, exactly. Well, we're going to treat those two things in separate chapters. So today we're going to look at just the electron transport part of oxidative phosphorylation. And that is summarized in this first slide. By the way, I posted an announcement today. Many of you probably haven't seen it yet. But if you get confused by following along, because the slides don't match, that's what my announcement was about. I just edited this show. So make sure that you use the 15-slide show when you follow along, because otherwise the slide numbers will be wrong. Anyway, the yellow thing here is representing what we're really going to focus on today, which is just a simple, it's not like this is just a single thing like it suggests here, but this yellow thing represents an electron transport chain, which is not only a complex of proteins, but several complexes of proteins. It's not just a single little yellow tube embedded in the membrane, but that's where the electron transport chains are, and I use the plural because there's not just one electron transport chain. There's not even just one electron transport chain per mitochondrion. There are many, many copies of the chain, but we call it the chain because they're all the same. Anyway, the electron transport chain that we're going to study is found in a mitochondrion, but specifically in the inner mitochondrial membrane. And it is a transducer. A transducer is something that transforms one form of energy into another. Like loudspeakers, for instance, are transducers because they transform electrical energy in the form of that AC signal that is delivered by the speaker cable to the actual loudspeaker, transforms that into mechanical sound waves that you eventually transduce in your brain to hearing. Why is the electron transport chain a transducer? What is it transducing? It's transducing energy in the form of electrons that have been stripped from the fuel at various places along the way that we've already talked about. Remember where we are now. We're at the beginning of cellular respiration, which is at the end of the tricarboxylic acid cycle. So the tricarboxylic acid cycle completes the oxidation of the fuel, and therefore we've stripped the fuel of as much stuff as we can. We've gotten all the electrons that we can get from the fuel. But where have those electrons been put up to now? Into the two major coenzymes, right. We've reduced NAD plus into NADH, and we've reduced FAD into FADH2. NADH, several places. FADH2 in the citric acid cycle. Okay, those are storing the energy in the form of electrons from the fuel. Now, the electron transport chain transduces that form of energy from electrons to another form of energy. What's that other form of energy? No? ATP is our ultimate goal. A concentration gradient of Protons, hydrogen ions, same thing. Exactly. That's why it's a transducer. It's transducing the energy we have from the fuel that's currently in the form of electrons stripped from that fuel, and it's storing that energy temporarily in the form of a hydrogen ion or proton gradient that the electron transport chain itself produces. Now, to produce a gradient, that means you need to pump the particles, because pumping always refers to moving something against its concentration gradient, right? To stockpile it, in other words, to take it where it's already scarce and put it to where it's already plentiful, to build it up. Well, pumping always requires energy because that particle wants to go the other way. It wants to go down its gradient, not up its gradient. And usually you think about pumps operating by spending energy in the form of ATP, because a lot of pumps do that, right? About 40% of the reason you eat, about 40% of your energy budget, by some estimates, is put into just powering your sodium-potassium exchange pumps of all your cells. That's using the ATP for that reason. Well, it wouldn't make sense to use ATP to power the pumps to make this proton gradient, right? Why would that not make sense? Because the goal is to make ATP. If you spend ATP to produce a gradient that you'll then use to make ATP, you're going to end up on the short end of the stick because of the laws of thermodynamics, right? You're going to lose some energy as heat, therefore you're going to spend more ATP than you're going to end up making if you did that. It would be wasteful. So the source of energy for these pumps is not ATP. The source of energy is what? What is the source of energy that powers the electrons themselves? You're right. The source of energy is the fact that transferring those electrons puts them successively into more and more stable positions. They're going down in energy, in other words, in G level. And therefore energy is released in those oxidation reduction reactions that each of these transfers is. Recognize that when you transfer electrons from member to member of the chain, what it really is a series of redox reactions. Because when the first member of the chain receives electrons, it's being reduced in the process, right? And it's oxidizing the thing that's dropping them off, because it's that thing that's dropping them off is losing electrons. But then that first member passes them on to the next member, and therefore the first member becomes reoxidized and it reduces the second member, and so on. In each of those redox reactions, a little bit of energy is released. Some of that energy is wasted as heat. There's nothing you can do about that, as usual. But much of that energy gets used to actually power the pumps, which can forcefully drag protons from one side of the membrane to the other against their gradient, and therefore establish and maintain the proton gradient. And when you have a gradient, that is a form of potential energy, and therefore it can do some work for you if the system is designed well. And that's exactly what's happening with electron transport. We're transducing the energy from the form of the electron stripped from the fuel to the form of a proton gradient, which then, in the final payoff, will phosphorylate ATP by the diffusion of protons down their gradient back to where they were pumped from, turning ATP synthase molecules. That's what the pink thing is. It's an ATP synthase molecule that operates via oxidative phosphorylation as long as it spins, and the thing that makes it spin is the protons diffusing back down their gradient. And you won't have that diffusion unless you have the gradient to begin with. That's why you need the pumping. Okay, now one confusing thing about this is that the way this TCA cycle, or tricarboxylic acid cycle, is drawn, it's spitting off electrons which it's sending to the electron transport chain. That's true. But it also kind of implies that it's spitting off CO2, which is somehow being sent to the ATP synthase. It's not. CO2 should have been drawn up here or something. It's just leaving the situation. It's not interacting with ATP synthase. By the way, the gray thing here represents just one of two membranes that are in a mitochondrion, right? This is the inner mitochondrial membrane. And so what is inside the inner mitochondrial membrane? The matrix. That's where the tricarboxylic acid cycle takes place. The outer background here, outside of the membrane, represents what? Fluid. The intermembrane space, which is still inside the mitochondrion. They just, for simplicity, they only drew one membrane. In slide two, we see both membranes, though, and I'm sure you've looked at mitochondrial anatomy before. It's a doubly membrane-bounded organelle, but the two membranes differ markedly. The outer membrane is really just a smooth covering. It's as big as it needs to be to cover the whole thing. The inner mitochondrial membrane is actually much bigger in terms of area, and that's because it is elaborated or folded repeatedly, each fold of which is called a crista, Christi for plurals, for a plural. And why do we have all these folds? To maximize the surface area. The more surface area you have in the inner mitochondrial membrane, the more protein complexes that make up electron transport chains you can fit or embed in that membrane. The more electron transport chains you have in a mitochondrion, the more pumping of protons you can process, and therefore the more oxidative phosphorylation of ADP into ATP can be undergone. The outer membrane, by the way, is much more permeable than the inner membrane. And so the intermembrane space is not very much different from cytosol, because things can easily go through that outer membrane. And that's why the outer surface of the inner membrane is sometimes called the cytosolic surface, even though it's not technically in direct contact with cytosol. That intermembrane space is more or less cytosol. The intermembrane requires a bunch of proteins to allow things into and out of it, which we'll talk more about in other chapters. All right, now let's go to slide three and talk about redox potentials or reduction potentials or electron transfer potentials. They all really mean the same thing. This table is calling them reduction potentials, but the symbol for that is E naught prime. And the E reminds you that this can also be called electron transfer potentials. Well, we've already talked in previous chapters about phosphoryl transfer potentials, right? And the higher something is on an ordered list of phosphoryl transfer potentials, the more likely it is to give up that phosphoryl group that it's carrying to something else, right? This is an analogous situation. The higher up on this list a substance is, which in this case means the more negative or the less positive the E naught prime value is, the more likely it is to transfer electrons to something below it in the list. All right, now these are all these values given for E naught prime here are comparative. They're relative values, meaning that they are all compared to some agreed upon standard. And the agreed upon standard is right here about two-thirds down, using the reduction of hydrogen ions into hydrogen, H2. That was agreed upon as the standard, which is why that's defined as zero, at least under standard conditions, which means pH of zero or one molar. All these other values are not at pH zero, by the way. They're at pH 7, which is why these are not E naught values. They're E naught prime. The difference between E naught and E naught prime is the same as the difference between G-naught and G-naught prime. The prime indicates that instead of standard conditions, which would be pH of 0, it's standard biochemical conditions, meaning conditions that are close to what actually happens in living cells, pH of 7 rather than pH of 0. But anyway, the main point, like I said, is that the higher up something is on this list, the more likely it is to give up electrons to something below it. All right? And let's look at some of these things that are in here. NAD, notice it's above FAD, and that should make sense, or that should agree with something I've already told you, right? That FAD is not really carrying as much potential energy as NAD is, which is why it has to drop its electrons off at a farther along point in the electron transport chain compared to NAD. The ones down here toward the bottom, well, these are members of the electron transport chain. And so when you go from member to member of the chain, you're just going down. Well, you're going up in value, really, because of the way these things are defined. You're going up in value for E naught prime, but that means you're going down in G value. You're getting, the electrons are going to a more and more stable situation. And that's the whole essence of it. That's the source of the energy that powers the electron, the pumping of protons. All right, let's look at the chain itself in slide 4. This is a graph, but it's also kind of anatomically drawn. So these are cartoon renditions of the protein complexes that make up the chain. They are embedded within the inner mitochondrial membrane. So that's where they're actually found. But they're drawn diagonally here because the vertical placement on this graph indicates their free energy relative to oxygen. Okay? So the higher on the graph, the higher the free energy. And they're going down stepwise based on what I told you. Because of what I've told you. Every time there is a transfer of an electron from one member to the next one in the line, there is a reduction in free energy. And that's the source of the energy that also allows these same protein complexes that are transferring the electrons to do their second job, just as important, of actually pumping the protons. Because if you didn't bother pumping the protons, you would waste all this energy that you have stored from the fuel in the form of electrons. You would just waste it as heat. You would make a lot more heat, but you wouldn't make any more ATP beyond what you've already made up to that point. And by far, most of the ATP per glucose molecule is made in that final step in oxidative phosphorylation because of this proton gradient. So oxygen is at the end here because of what oxygen does in your body, right? Almost the only reason you need oxygen is to serve as the final electron acceptor for your style of respiration. What makes it respiration? The pumping of these protons. So respiration requires a membrane across which protons get pumped in order to make that gradient so that oxidative phosphorylation can occur. That's what makes it respiration. And that's why fermentation is not respiration. Fermentation is an anaerobic process, but it's not respiration. There is such a thing as anaerobic respiration. It will use an electron transport chain just like ours does. But at the far end of that, receiving the electrons from the chain will be something other than oxygen. And that's why it's anaerobic respiration. Okay? The majority of respiring organisms, though, including us, are aerobically respiring organisms. So aerobic respiration is what we study in most detail. Now, what is it about oxygen that makes it ideally suited to being the final electron acceptor? Well, if you look at the list, Notice oxygen's right down there at the bottom. But what did you already know about oxygen before I even told you about reduction potentials that makes it a good candidate for receiving electrons? Exactly. It has a high electronegativity, so it's willing to take on those electrons. Well, it doesn't take just the electrons on, it takes on the protons as well. And so really, at the end of the line, what you're doing is adding hydrogen atoms to oxygen in that reduction of oxygen. Oxygen gets reduced into water. That's why water is on the right side of the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose. It's a result of oxygen receiving those electrons and protons. Now, there are four numbered complexes in here, as you see, and they're numbered with Roman numerals. That's one way to refer to them, complex 1, 2, 3, and 4. They also, of course, have names, and as you've kind of gotten used to in biochemistry, not only do they have names, but they can have multiple names, any of which you can call them. So you might find different names in different books. The first one, the purple one, and it's the first, it's reasonable to call that complex one because it's the first to operate in the process. As you see here, one of its names, other than complex one, is NADH coenzyme Q reductase. Now, Q is just short for coenzyme Q. Sometimes it's written, though, as CoQ. We'll talk more about coenzyme Q in a minute. Another name for this, though, is NADH dehydrogenase. It refers to the same thing. Well, if you use the name NADH coenzyme Q reductase, that's kind of a good name to memorize because it makes it easy to remember what's happening here. Electrons are being passed from NADH to coenzyme Q. Okay, that's why that's the order of those things in the name, NADH, coenzyme Q. And it's a reductase because it's reducing coenzyme Q. Coenzyme Q is receiving those electrons, so it's becoming reduced. Right? Well, this is the place where the NADH produced in the previous steps drop their cargo of electrons off to the electron transport chain at the very first member of the chain, complex 1. So just keep in mind that NADH was produced in glycolysis. It was produced in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, and it was also produced in the citric acid cycle. It gets delivered here. Coenzyme Q is also called ubiquinone. It's an example of a quinone, which we'll look at the structure of in a minute. But it's called ubiquinone because it is ubiquitous, meaning ever-present. Ubiquitous means always there. That's the basis of the name. But ubiquinone, as we'll see, exists in different forms. Well, actually, all of these things exist in different forms, right? They all exist in oxidized and reduced forms. But we'll call Q, coenzyme Q, different things depending on how oxidized or reduced it is. Anyway, it receives the electrons from complex 1. But it also can receive electrons from complex 2. Complex 2 gets several names as well. You can call it complex 2. You can also call it the succinate dehydrogenase complex, which we've already talked about, right? What is succinate dehydrogenase complex part of? The citric acid cycle. Remember I said that that's the only one of the enzymes involved that's actually embedded in the membrane. The rest of those were free enzymes in the matrix. But the succinate dehydrogenase one was part of the inner mitochondrial membrane. Well, it's not only part of the membrane, it is also a member of this electron transport chain. And recall what it does. It takes electrons, right, from succinate in the form of hydrogen atoms, but electrons and protons in other words, and puts them onto FAD to make FADH2. But remember I said that FAD never leaves that enzyme complex. So it immediately drops its electrons that it just received from the fuel onto coenzyme Q, just like complex 1 does. So we can call this thing succinate dehydrogenase, we can call it complex 2, or we can also call it succinate coenzyme Q reductase. And that name is completely analogous to NADH coenzyme Q reductase, right? Because except that it's taking it from succinate instead of NADH. But it's taking it from succinate via FADH2. Now, there's, as you see here, four numbered complexes. 1, 2, 3, and 4, the Roman numerals. But only 3 of them operate as pumps. So they all operate as redox members. They all become reduced and then reoxidize when they pass their electrons on to something else. But only complexes 1, 3, and 4 also can pump protons to establish and maintain that proton gradient. Complex 2 does not. And so this now finally explains or finishes up the explanation of why FADH2 isn't as valuable in terms of ATP payoff as NADH is. FADH2 passes its electrons through the succinate dehydrogenase complex to coenzyme Q, but because that succinate dehydrogenase complex, or complex 2, whatever you want to call it, does not pump any protons in that process, that means you're really bypassing the pump that is complex 1. You're putting the electrons in the same place that complex 1 will put them, but without pumping protons. And therefore, the only pumping of protons are going to be from the downstream part after coenzyme Q, which those electrons share the same pathway, whether they came from complex 1 or 2. In other words, the electrons in FADH2 do not lead to the pumping of as many protons as electrons that come from NADH, and therefore fewer protons are going to be able to diffuse back into the matrix through ATPase enzymes to make ATP. Okay? So now we're at coenzyme Q, ubiquinone, and that's going to pass electrons off to complex 3. Now, complex 3 also can go by cytochrome C reductase, the name cytochrome C reductase. Or, it can, that's kind of a nickname, can also go by the name of coenzyme Q cytochrome C reductase, which is actually the better name, in my opinion, because it follows the style of the names we've been using so far. Right, NADH coenzyme Q reductase says where the electrons start and end. Succinate coenzyme Q reductase says where the electrons begin and end. Coenzyme Q cytochrome C reductase says where the electrons start and end. Right, they're being received from coenzyme Q. They're going to go to cytochrome C. Now, coenzyme Q, as we'll see more the structure of in a minute, is a mobile component of the electron transport chain. These major complexes, it's not that they're permanently in place, but they're not freely moving around in the membrane. Not as freely moving around. For one thing, they're much huger. Ubiquinone, though, can travel around, still embedded in the membrane. But remember that a membrane is a fluid mosaic, right? And things that are in part of the membrane can move around within it. That's true of coenzyme Q. cytochrome C is actually not embedded in the membrane. Cytochrome C is a water-soluble protein complex that is associated, but loosely associated, with the inner mitochondrial membrane. So it's just associated with the surface of the membrane. It's not embedded within that phospholipid interior, or that hydrophobic tail interior of the membrane, like the others are. So cytochrome C receives electrons from the cytochrome C, or the coenzyme Q cytochrome C reductase complex, complex 3 in other words, and then passes them on to the final numbered complex, complex 4, which also goes by the name of cytochrome C oxidase, not reductase. Okay? Cytochrome C oxidase will take the electrons received from cytochrome C and then put them onto oxygen along with protons to reduce oxygen into water. So that's where oxygen is finally doing its job. After you breathed it in, put it into your blood, pumped it around the body, diffused it out of the blood into your cells, now that oxygen is finally doing what its job is, to receive those electrons and protons from the fuel to turn into water. Not because you want the water, right? I mean, it's water. It's as valuable as any other water. But that's not the goal here. The goal is to receive the electrons from complex 4 simply so complex 4 can receive more electrons. In other words, so you can continue the operation of the entire electron transport chain and therefore maintain that gradient, because if the minute you stop pumping, I mean, the minute you stop the transfer of electrons, you also stop the pumping of protons. And so the protons that are diffusing back in through ATP synthase molecules, they won't diffuse anymore once they come to equilibrium. When the gradient is dissipated, they're not going to come back into the matrix. They're therefore not going to spin the ATP synthase molecules, and you won't phosphorylate any more ADP. So that will shut down cellular respiration. Now, I said that 1, 3, and 4 are operating as pumps. Those actually produce the proton gradient. Notice that Fe appears several places in this chain. Iron is an important component in the electron transport chain complexes. But even though iron has by itself a certain value on the table, if you look it up, that we looked at, for reduction potential, it's not just iron acting by itself in these complexes. Iron is associated with different things in different complexes and in different ways. And therefore, the overall combination of iron and the things that it's associated with give those different combinations different reduction potentials. And therefore, it makes sense that you can continue to use iron as you go down in energy level from step to step. Well, in slide 5, we see some of the ways in which iron is complexed with other things and members of these of the chain. These are all, ABC here, are all examples. They're different examples, but they're all examples of iron being complexed with sulfur. So they're all examples of what we call iron-sulfur clusters. Now, a cysteine amino acid residue, which is part of the overall protein complex, but any given cysteine residue has sulfur in it already, right? We've already talked about disulfide bonds involving cysteine. So that's one way in which an iron can be complexed with sulfur, just directly to cysteine residues. Or it can be also associated with sulfide ions between the irons, which are then in turn associated with cysteines. And there's different numbers of sulfide ions that can be involved, but these all involve sulfur and iron interactions. Since they are different kinds of interactions, though, each of these different examples will have a different redox potential, or reduction potential. These are distinct, though, from heme, which also involves iron. Slide 6 shows you a heme group, which is also used in hemoglobin, right? Which carries oxygen in the blood. Well, the iron sulfur clusters are also called non-heme, just to distinguish them from the use of iron in heme. Well, there are non-heme sulfur iron sulfur clusters in the electron transport chain, but there are also heme groups, specifically cytochrome. And cytochrome C is the one we'll focus on, but it's not the only cytochrome. The cytochromes, though, use heme as the business end of the molecule. Cytochrome literally means cell color, right? And that's because heme is a pigment. That's why blood changes its color depending on its oxygenation status. All right. Let's look at slide 7. This is the general structure of isoprene. And the reason that's important is that we're going to have an isoprene tail consisting of some number of these isoprenes end to end. And I say some number because the number actually depends on the species. But when you hook together a bunch of isoprenes, what you have is a hydrocarbon tail, right? Because there's only carbon and hydrogen here. And a hydrocarbon tail has what property? It is hydrophobic, and therefore has no problem being right around the equally hydrophobic hydrocarbon tails of phospholipids. In other words, a tail of isoprenes is a way of anchoring something in the membrane by keeping it buoyed in that hydrophobic center or thickness of the membrane itself. Well, that's exactly what we have in the case of coenzyme Q, shown in slide 8. So the isoprene that we just looked at is represented by what's in the blue parentheses here. And the 10 here means that in us, in our example, there's 10 of these. But like I said, however many it is depends on the species. Anyway, that is just a way of anchoring this coenzyme Q in the membrane. Anchoring, it might be a bad word, though, because like I said, it's not stuck in place. Coenzyme Q is moving around all the time. But what keeps it in the membrane and not just going out into the matrix or the intermembrane space is the fact that it has this isoprene tail. All right, so what we see here left to right is that there are three different versions of coenzyme Q that differ in the oxidation reduction status. So what we call just Q by itself as a symbol refers to ubiquinone, which is the fully oxidized form of coenzyme Q. And like I said before, it's called ubiquinone because that's short for ubiquitous quinone or quinone. You can pronounce it either way. But a quinone is a derivative of benzene, so you have the familiar ring. But what makes it a quinone is that it has two keto groups in that ring. Notice the two carbonyls. Those are what really allow it to become reduced sequentially. So this is the fully oxidized form. If you receive an electron and a proton, I mean, if ubiquinone receives an electron and a proton, which is the E minus and the H plus, and that's what it does, by the way, it receives an electron and a proton, then that's going to transform Q, or ubiquinone, into QH, symbolically, which we call semiquinone. All right? So it's not like NAD and NADH is just oxidized or reduced only. It's fully oxidized and then partially reduced. That's the semiquinone. And then if you do the same thing, receive another electron plus a couple protons, then it can be completely reduced, in which case symbolically we call it QH2, But QH2 is just a symbol for the name ubiquinol. So careful with those words. Ubiquinone is fully oxidized. Ubiquinol is fully reduced. It's carrying 2 electrons. Okay? And those electrons come from where? Well, they come from either complex 1, if it's NADH carrying the electrons, or they come from complex 2, if it's FADH2 carrying the electrons. Remember, they both deliver those to the same thing, coenzyme Q. So ubiquinone receives them to transform it into ubiquinol stepwise. All right, slide 9. It's just a flowchart rendition of the electron transport chain. This one is written, though, vertically because you have corresponding E0 prime values indicating the reduction potential. So as we go down in G, or energy level, we're going up numerically in E0 prime values, as we discussed before. NADHQ oxidoreductase receives its electrons from NADH, delivers them to coenzyme Q. At the same time, though, that energy drop is able to power the pumping of protons. Succinate Q reductase, succinate coenzyme Q reductase, will deliver electrons to coenzyme Q as well, but via FADH2. Without the pumping of protons. Coenzyme Q receives them from both of these. So this is the place we are. Its job now, coenzyme's Q job, specifically, ubiquinol's job, that's the reduced form, is to deliver those newly acquired electrons to the next member of the chain, the next complex, which is the coenzyme Q cytochrome C reductase, third name here. Can also be called oxidoreductase, but usually it's called reductase. Of course, if you have a reduction occurring, something else is being oxidized, so they really can all be called oxidoreductases. But anyway, that coenzyme Q cytochrome C oxidoreductase, or just reductase complex, is going to deliver those electrons to cytochrome C. And cytochrome C is another mobile component of the chain. Although, unlike coenzyme Q, the other mobile component, it is not linked to the interior of the membrane via a hydrophobic component, that isoprene tail. Instead, cytochrome C is just loosely associated with the actual surface, which makes sense based on what I've told you, namely that cytochrome C is water-soluble. It has no problem being around the hydrophilic heads of those phospholipids, but it doesn't want to be around the tails. Okay, and finally, cytochrome C delivers it to cytochrome C oxidase, which then is going to send it to oxygen, making it into water. Now, in slide 10, we're looking at a problem that needs to be solved by this whole mechanism. The problem is that coenzyme Q, by going from ubiquinone to semiquinone to ubiquinol, receives 2 electrons. And it needs to pass both of those off in order for the chain to continue to operate. But cytochrome C is able to receive only 1 electron, not 2. So there needs to be a way to deal with this mismatch. And that's what's being schematically illustrated here. So this is the coenzyme Q cytochrome C reductase complex that's being outlined in black here. The Q pool just refers to all the coenzyme Qs that are there, which are, some of them are in the ubiquinone form, some of them are in the semiquinone form, some of them are in ubiquinol form. But the incoming one on the left here really represents ubiquinol, fully reduced form, because it's just received 2 electrons from either complex 1 or complex 2. All right? Within the complex 3, which we're looking at here, there are two places for coenzyme Q to bind, which means two separate coenzyme Q molecules can be bound here temporarily. The one labeled Q pool to the left, which is ubiquinol, is coming in and occupying what I'm just going to call the top slot. Top doesn't really make sense in the cell, but in the figure it does. It's operating this top slot. So notice the QH2. Remember, QH2 means ubiquinol, the fully reduced form. It has two electrons it's going to give up. The electrons being given up are represented by the pink arrows. Okay? But those electrons go different places. One of the two electrons goes to a cytochrome C, an oxidized form of cytochrome C, which is going to turn it into the reduced form of cytochrome C, which is exactly what we want to happen, right? But like I said, cytochrome C can only receive one. The other electron, meanwhile, goes to a different coenzyme Q molecule that's already stuck on this slot, this lower slot. And notice it is just Q by itself, not QH2. What is Q by itself? What's the name for that? Ubiquinone, the fully oxidized form. And so ubiquinone receiving an electron from a ubiquinol is going to transform that ubiquinone into semiquinone. All right? Now, another Q comes along, another ubiquinol comes along, and does the same thing. Binds to that top slot and it's going to give one of its electrons to a different cytochrome C, or reducing it. And its second electron is now going to go be added to the semiquinone from the first step in the bottom slot. And that's going to transform the semiquinone into ubiquinol. And then it's done its job and it can detach, become part of the Q pool. Notice, though, that in this second step, that involves two hydrogens. Okay? Two hydrogens get released at the top here, come in at the bottom, get released at the top. So this is part of the proton gradient that's being built up. But it also accomplishes what I said was the problem, that coenzyme Q is carrying two electrons, it needs to drop it off to something that can only carry one. Well, it ends up dropping it off to two of those, two cytochrome Cs. Okay? Now we're at the final complex. That last one was complex 3. This is complex 4 in slide 11. And remember, complex 4 is where oxygen finally does its job. So it's eventually going to receive those electrons and some protons, but doesn't happen right away. First, you have to have both of the cytochrome Cs that you just reduced in the previous step. They come into complex 4. You see that at the top. Okay, one at a time, they deliver their one electron each off to the complex. And within that complex, the electron kind of gets passed around. But one of those electrons is going to end up on a copper that's part of the complex. Another one ends up on an iron. Okay? Specifically a heme iron. So if you follow the arrow, it looks like it's just all ending up at copper, but copper will receive one and iron will receive the other one from the other cytochrome C. Well, this, of course, reduces both the iron and the copper. So the blue copper and the blue iron, blue here represents oxidized. Pink means reduced. When they're in their reduced state, then that allows oxygen to come in and say, well, here are some electrons that I can grab for myself. The reduced iron and copper have electrons that they didn't have before. Oxygen wants to steal them, basically. So you see the oxygen molecule arranging itself so that one of the oxygen atoms is going to strip away an electron from copper and the other one's going to strip away an electron from iron. The two oxygens being temporarily bound to these copper and iron components forms what's called a peroxide bridge. Very temporary. Okay, now you have two more cytochrome C's come around and do the same thing, drop off their one electron each. They trickle through the components of the complex and end up exactly the same places associated with the copper and the iron, but specifically on the oxygens that are on those two metal ions. And so instead of having the peroxide bridge, which was between the two oxygens still, the electrons, with the help of two protons that come into the situation from the bottom, turn these two oxygens each into a hydroxyl. So the oxygens are no longer associated with each other. Instead, each one is bound to a hydrogen, but also bound to the metal ion, either copper or iron. So these are hydroxylated metal ions, okay, for the moment, which is why it consumed two protons in the process. And then when two more protons come into the situation, that actually transforms the two hydroxyls. A hydroxyl and a proton form what? Water. Right? Just like when water auto-ionizes, it forms two ions, hydroxyl and hydrogen ion. Well, the reverse can return you to water. So these two hydrogen ions in the final step here, or the bottom left step, it's a cycle really, is going to release those oxygens, but in the form of water. All right? So you have two waters coming off the situation, and that resets everything back into the oxidized state. Copper and iron are both oxidized now, and they therefore are ready to receive two new electrons from two new cytochrome C's. And that will happen as long as oxygen is there to keep receiving these electrons and protons. Okay, now, these hydrogen ions or protons that are coming into the bottom are not being pumped. They are just players, stoichiometric players in this game, in the actual chemical reaction. But since they're being consumed, they're being used, and because they're being taken out of solution from the matrix, even though they're not being pumped to the other side of the membrane, they still contribute to the gradient. Right? Because if you just remove hydrogen ions from one side of the membrane, that means you now have a lower hydrogen ion concentration there than you did before, and therefore the gradient is steeper, even though you haven't put them onto the other side. So this contributes to the magnitude of the proton gradient, the fact that these protons are consumed. But to make it even more efficient, as we're in slide 12 now, in addition to those protons consumed in order to make water, there are additional four protons that get pumped through the complex because that production of water by reducing oxygen is very exergonic. It releases a lot of energy, enough energy to power the pumping of additional protons beyond the ones that are consumed. So you're really removing eight protons from solution, four of which are going to go on to the other side, and that really contributes greatly to the proton gradient. All right, well, that's electron transport, and it's summarized on slide 13, although I noticed an error in this picture. The cytochrome C complex right here, I said was loosely associated with the inner mitochondrial membrane, and it is. But it's loosely associated with the cytosolic side, or the side facing the intermembrane space, not the side facing the matrix. So this thing should be on the top part of the membrane in this picture, not the bottom part. It doesn't matter, really, to your understanding of how the electron transport chain works, but that is, in reality, where it should be. This was just drawn incorrectly. But notice you have protons being pumped by the three complexes that operate as pumps, 1, 3, and 4, but not 2. And keep in mind that the direction of pumping is from the matrix. That's where the protons are pumped from and put into the intermembrane space. And therefore, those protons, because of that gradient, want to diffuse back into the matrix from the intermembrane space. Now, why are they not going to be allowed to easily diffuse back into the matrix? And why aren't they permeable? I mean, why isn't the membrane permeable to protons, freely permeable? Right, because they are ions. Ions are beyond polar, right? They are fully charged particles. And even though a proton is the smallest possible ion, and small things can more easily make their way through the actual phospholipid bilayer, ions don't, because that charge is not compatible with the hydrophobic interior formed by the tail-to-tail arrangement. Now that's important, because if protons could just leak back through the phospholipid bilayer easily, we would waste all this energy that we got from the food. Because we no longer have any fuel left. The TCA cycle spent it all. We also no longer have any electrons to work with, because they've all been put to oxygen. So the only energy we have to work with that came from glucose is in the form of this proton gradient. That will only be put to work, just like water spilling over a water wheel, if that water is guaranteed to go over the wheel and not just spill beside it. So if protons were able to leak through the phospholipid bilayer, they wouldn't spin the ATP synthase molecules. But the ATP synthases are the only places where these protons can easily get back into the matrix, which they want to do because of their gradient. And that's where they come back in, just like water being forced by spilling down a channel to go over a water wheel, which can grind your corn or whatever. Slide 14, I'm not going to read to you. This is just a list of suspected disorders, disorders that are suspected of being caused by oxidative stress. So we're done with the electron transport chain as it runs normally. But the problem is sometimes oxygen receives electrons prematurely in the process, particularly in complexes 1 and 3. Remember, oxygen is not supposed to be involved until complex 4. But sometimes oxygen will receive electrons prematurely in the process. It's always happening to a certain low level. And that produces what are called collectively reactive oxygen species, or ROS, that includes superoxide ions, peroxide, various other things. These reactive oxygen species are, as the name implies, reactive. That's why they're dangerous things to have in the cell, because they will react with just about all the macromolecules that a cell is made out of, including DNA. When you start damaging DNA, you can cause genetic disorders, right? When you mess with the DNA, you can cause things to happen that are nasty. But it can also damage other things as well, proteins. So we don't want this to happen very much, obviously. And there are things put in place in the cells to minimize the effect of these reactive oxygen species. In slide 15, we're looking at one such thing. The circle here, which is the same thing in all cases, it's just in different forms, either oxidized or reduced, but the circle itself refers to an enzyme, or I mean represents an enzyme, called superoxide dismutase. D-I-S mutase. Now, dismutase or dismutation refers to taking a product and splitting it into taking a reactant and splitting it into two different products. And that's exactly what's happening when you start with superoxide. Superoxide, by the way, is represented here by O2 minus dot. The dot represents that this is a radical. A radical refers to an unpaired electron, which is an unstable situation, which is why this thing wants to react with stuff quickly. But anyway, superoxide, which is what is produced when you have this premature interaction between electrons and oxygen at complexes 1 and 3. So the superoxide is dangerous, so the cell deals with it by sending that superoxide, as like I said, it's continuously being produced at a low level. It sends it to superoxide dismutase, the circle enzyme. And at first, the enzyme, which is labeled M here, that's the dismutase, it's in the oxidized state. When it receives an electron from superoxide, that's going to transform that just into oxygen. Okay, the reason this is a dismutation is that that O2 is one of the products. The other product is down here, hydrogen peroxide. Okay, but anyway, that the reception of the electron from superoxide is going to reduce the oxidized form of superoxide dismutase into the reduced form, the pink one. But then it can go to work and receive another superoxide molecule, and with the help of an incoming a couple of protons, transform that into hydrogen peroxide, which reoxidizes or resets the enzyme for another round. So that's why it's called dismutase. You're taking superoxide and transforming the oxygen of that superoxide is going into two different products, oxygen and peroxide. Well, the oxygen is just like the oxygen you breathe, so it can do its normal job and function with complex 4. Hydrogen peroxide, H2O2, is in itself dangerous because it's reactive, and therefore it has to be dealt with by a different enzyme, which is called catalase. So catalase takes what superoxide dismutase spits out and then deals with it, transforms the hydrogen peroxide just into water. Okay? Oh, we're done. Let me give you the tests. I'll let you look at them.